Holy Daniel, they're fine, I've been waiting for this.
Okay, paper 10. Again, Bernadette.
Right. Okay, moving on to something a little bit different. So, long-term interest, if we are ready. So, agenda paper 10 addresses an issue relating to the interaction between IFRS 9 and IAS 28 in the context of long-term interest in an associate or joint venture. And specifically, the question is whether the impairment of long-term interest should be accounted for under IAS 28, IFRS 9, or a combination of both standards. And so the original submission is reproduced in Appendix C of a staff paper. And the submitter points out that paragraph 2.1a of IFRS 9 excludes interest in associates and joint ventures that are accounted for in accordance with IAS 28, but does not go into any further detail regarding what is meant by an interest in an associate or joint venture. However, IAS 28 specifically notes that in the context of the allocation of losses, an interest in an associate or joint venture is made up of the carrying value of the investment plus any long-term interest, which in substance form part of the net investment. And then it goes on to require an entity to determine whether that net investment has been impaired, and then furthermore test the entire carrying amount of that investment for impairment in accordance with IAS 36. And so the question raised relates to a long-term interest which is in the form of an interest-bearing loan, which would otherwise be wholly within the scope of IFRS 9. And the submitter is questioning whether the scope exemption from IFRS 9 relating to interest in associates and joint ventures should be interpreted to include such a long-term interest, and in particular in the context of the impairment requirements. And so the submitter considers that there's already quite a lot of diversity in practice, but that to date there has not been a significant difference between IAS 39 impairment models and IAS 28, 36 models, and therefore it's only really becoming an issue now with the new expected credit loss model under IFRS 9. And so there's four alternative views that are presented, and they're set out in detail in paragraphs 12 to 17 of the staff paper. So the first view is that the long-term interest should be entirely within the scope of IFRS 9 and only within the scope of 28 in respect of the allocation of losses. View B is that long-term interest is in the scope of IFRS 9 but within the scope of IAS 28, not only for the allocation of losses but also for impairment. So that would be in scope of two sets of impairment requirements. View C is that IFRS 9 doesn't apply at all, and we should be accounting for this type of instrument using the equity method. And the last view is that IFRS 9 does apply from a classification and measurement perspective, with the exception of impairment, and then IAS 28 takes over in terms of impairment and also for the allocation of losses. So again, in terms of outreach, we asked our securities regulators, standard setters and large firms for their views. And the feedback received did indicate that there was diversity in practice. So many respondents noted that they felt their requirements were unclear and considered that some or all of the views presented were supportable. And also a lot of respondents noted that they had either observed existing diversity or expected it to arise upon application of IFRS 9. An argument supporting all of the views presented were provided by the respondents, and they're set out in paragraphs 23 to 29 of the staff paper. So turning then to our staff analysis. So in order to address the question, we firstly considered whether a long-term interest in the form of this interest-bearing loan should be within the scope of IFRS 9. And then we considered separately what the implications of the IAS 28 references to the long-term interest were. So the first question then of whether the long-term interest should be within the scope of IFRS 9. So this is set out in paragraphs 40 to 46 of the staff paper. And so in order to establish whether or not it should be outside the scope of IFRS 9, it's the question of whether it's considered to be part of the interest in associate or joint venture that are referred to in paragraph 2.1a of IFRS 9 as being scoped out. And we found some additional guidance in IAS 28 was useful in this regard. So first of all, paragraph 14 of IS 28 notes that it elaborates on the IFRS 9 scope exemption and notes that interest in associates and joint ventures that are accounted for using the equity method are outside the scope of IFRS 9. So then you would have to have concluded that the long-term interest should be prima facie equity accounted before getting it out of scope of 9. We also noted that paragraph 38, which is this paragraph in IS 28, which specifically refers to the long-term interest, when it's explaining what makes up the net investment, it refers only to the carrying amount of the investment as being the item that's determined using the equity method, whereas it's silent on the accounting for the long-term interest. And finally, the definition of the equity method itself also refers to it in the context of the investment rather than the net investment. So based on all of that and considering that the fundamental nature of the long-term interest was a financial instrument, we didn't think that it should have been accounted for using the equity method, and therefore it should be within the scope of IFRS 9. But in saying that, paragraph 38 of IS 28 makes very specific reference to this type of instrument. So we then went on to consider what the implications of that reference were. And that's set out in paragraphs 47 to 58 of our staff paper. So we thought that there was two implications of that reference. First of all, it brings the long-term interest into the scope of IS 28 in the context of the allocation of losses. But in addition, because that paragraph 38 describes it as being part of the net investment, we felt that it also brought it into the scope of IS 28 in the context of impairment requirements pertaining to the net investment. And then when we went to look at the requirements for the impairment of the net investment, we noted that the indicators that are set out for impairment are very similar to the incurred loss type indicators that were there under IS 39. And last of all, we just noted that another paragraph within IS 28, paragraph 41, does specifically refer to interests other than long-term interests, so interests that wouldn't have been considered part of the net investment, and specifically requires that they should be impaired under IFRS 9. And so based on that analysis, we thought that the accounting for long-term interest is going to be based on a combination of both standards, primarily within the scope of 9 for classification and measurement, excluding impairment, but then in the scope of 28 for the allocation of losses and impairment. Now, in saying that, we do note that IFRS 9 does not specifically scope out long-term interest from the impairment requirements, and that is certainly an issue. But we did think that the more specific guidance in IS 28 should take precedence, because we thought, well, we didn't feel that it should be in the scope of two different sets of impairment requirements, and especially as well because they are quite different. And so from a consistency perspective, it would lead to the same model for impairment across the entire net investment. And so I guess our recommendation is that we acknowledge that the results of the outreach have indicated that there are divergent views, and it certainly was apparent from the views of respondents. However, we do think it is possible to deduce the appropriate accounting from existing IFRSs without the need for further guidance. And so we recommended that the committee not take it on to its agenda, but obviously our first question is whether or not you have any questions on that or whether you agree with our recommendation.
Question before we turn to that. If the committee said, nah, we don't think it's an agenda decision. Yeah. Is it an annual improvement or is it really an amendment to one of the standards? I didn't ask that earlier, so I'm surprising you with it.
I think we'll have, if it is something of an amendment, first question is which standard do we amend? And
right.
We'll have to evaluate that and to what is the extent. I think with the annual improvements, and Michael, I discussed this with Michael, there are certain due process requirements for an annual improvement, aren't there?
There are. And I mean, an annual improvement is effectively in some ways no different than an error scope amendment, but it has to meet certain additional criteria that indicate that it's relatively minor. So it's about clarifying wording or addressing an unintended oversight. So in this particular case, it would be a case of, does this fall into, I think, does this fall into an unintended oversight or not, or is it something different from that?
Sue?
I would have thought that it would depend on what it is that the committee was thinking we were shooting for in terms of the clarification, because I would have thought that an annual improvement needs to be something pretty benign, and if it was something that wasn't benign, at least for everybody applying the standard, then we'd probably need to think about it. I had a view E when I thought about the paper myself, but I'll wait and see what other people come up with first. Because what's missing for me in all of this is I don't really, and maybe you can help me with this, Bernadette, but I don't really know what the objective of all of this was when you get to 28. So when I stood back and did this impairment assessment in 28, was I trying to say, you know, if I look at IFRS 9, I've done my impairment in IFRS 9, I've done my equity accounting, I've done my allocation of losses.
Yeah.
I now look at that aggregate thing that I've created, and then I stand back and look at that as an associate. Do I now have a number that I feel still needs something done to it or not? Was that what the mindset was, in which case I might have a different view E, or was it something else that was trying to be achieved? And I just don't know what the context is of what the whole thing's shooting for.
I mean, it's difficult because it goes back to the 2003 amendment to IAS 28, but the discussion around that and in the base of conclusions focuses very much on widening the base upon which that you would have more carrying value to allocate your losses. It didn't really talk about the subsequent knock-on effect, so I don't even know if it was intended, but that's the reading of the standard. It's quite clear, I think, that it is part of the net investment. Paragraph 38 refers to it as being part of the net investment, so it's hard to then read the rest of the standard and not consider it to be, to form part of that, and then you end up falling into the impairment. But I didn't see anything in the basis of conclusions that was really telling me directly.
Okay, let's start with Andrew.
Well, it's a thorny issue. I really balk at that word in the staff recommendation, deduce. The appropriate accounting can be deduced. Yeah. That's hardly reflective of a kind of aspirational level of clarity.
Yeah.
If you need to go through and forensically join the dots, and I do think you could, if you could deduce the appropriate accounting, you could also deduce the inappropriate accounting if you join the dots in a different way. But more specifically, I really can't read IFRS 9 to contemplate scoping a debt instrument in for classification and measurement purposes, but not for expected loss impairment.
Yeah.
It just doesn't contemplate that, doesn't do that.
No.
There is, I actually think, where you'd like to get to is tentatively anyway probably the most appropriate place, that we do actually classify and measure under amortized cost accounting but do impairment under IAS 28. We certainly don't want to have two impairment tests, but there is just a concern about the coherence of applying the amortized cost method without the expected loss. And we're going to carry on recognizing if we get to some incurred loss level of impairment, and we're still going to carry on recognising 100 cents in the dollar of interest income under the amortised cost method, which is where you get to, and then kind of impair that away under IAS 36. That doesn't seem like a very satisfactory place to be. So I think we do need clarity on this. As you say, it's not a new issue, but it becomes much more pressing under expected loss impairment accounting. I think we need to fix it, and I actually don't think we can get there with an agenda decision. I think it's probably an amendment.
Okay, I've got John, Bonnie, Bruce, Bob, and Tony.
I agree with the staff analysis, although I think you can get to view B as well, that you're in both standards for impairment. I think you are in IAS 28 impairment for the reasons that are set out in the paper, but I do think also you're not scoped out of IFRS 9 impairment. I would tend to agree with view B, because I think when there are more specific requirements that apply, you actually go for the more specific. That's sort of a principle that usually applies if something is more specifically addressed within
view D.
But I do think technically you can read it as view B, because I don't see you scoped out of 9, and you're clearly in the scope of 28 as well. So I don't think it's an agenda decision. I think it is it is some form of amendment. But I do think it's an issue that needs to be dealt with. There is diversity in practice out there. There's very strongly held views about it, and there's even support for view A and view C out there in practice as well. So, but I would tend to think view D is the is the better answer. I mean, if it is forming part of your investment in the associate, it makes sense to me that it's the impairment requirements are those that are applicable to an equity method investment in an associate, rather than applying an expected credit loss model to one piece and then some other form of impairment test to another piece. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Bonnie?
So I echo some of the same comments that have been expressed by Andrew and John. As I was starting to read through the paper before I got to kind of the staff analysis, I noted that view C seemed the most reasonable and logical to me, because if the long-term receivable really is part of your equity for, or considered part of your equity under other standards, IS 21 and others, then why would you carve that out and look at it differently for impairment perspectives? I guess maybe it's a bit black or white, but either it's part of your investment or it's not. So having this hybrid approach seems very confusing to me. So I also agree with Andrew that I don't know that you can really get to the right answer, particularly if there's five or more views up to, you know, what potentially could be an appropriate accounting.
Bruce?
Thanks. My views are pretty much same as John's in terms of where they were. The only thing I'd said is that I also don't like the idea of having to do two different models onto the same investment. I think it's very counterintuitive. I would just echo the comments that have been made that when we spoke to people about this, they are definitely differing views and being read very, very differently. So I was going to say the same thing. I do not think we can address this through an agenda decision at all. And interesting, I know the staff paper come to the view of having deduced the answer. I thought that was it was very well worded, but it was it was a little bit of a leap of faith. I think that, you know, I could have built the same paper around any of the arguments, and I'm saying that's my concern. So I just think that the diversity is just too far.
Kang-Soo?
I just echo to John and Bruce. No, I agree. I mean, first of all, I agree with the conclusion of the staff. I have no objection about that. But I'm worrying that we are applying different impairment model for the same thing. So that is not our issue, but that is the issue of the IASB, I guess. So they, I think, have to think about whether the equity account, you know, the equity account investment should be, you know, a kind of exception from the IFRS 9. So that's about that.
Reinhardt?
Really, the similar comments to the others. I think particularly picking up on one of the points that Andrew made in terms of the need for some clarity in the guidance is because once you made that impairment under IAS 36, I'm not sure how you apply amortized cost accounting to the receivable itself if it's in the scope of IFRS 9 for measurement other than impairment. So supporting what others have said.
Bob?
Very similar comments. Really don't believe we can deal with this with an agenda decision. When I've dealt with this before, I've answered it under view B, because I think it is in both standards, it is required to be looked at it for impairment under both standards. Now, I'm not very happy with that answer. I think that produces unnecessary complexity. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy with going down the desired result of a view D, the staff's analysis. I can support that, but I'd have to support that to an amendment rather than an agenda decision.
Yeah. Tony?
Very similar. There's nothing that I can see that takes this out of the scope of IFRS 9, and I don't think we can deduce a scope exclusion and therefore go with an agenda decision. So I think at the moment it is in the scope of both. There are divergent views, so I think we need to decide, I guess, firstly, what the mechanism is, and then secondly, what we think the answer is. I share, I think, Reinhardt and Andrew's concerns that I'm just not sure how I apply the amortized cost model if I'm going to be doing the impairment under IAS 36. And I think maybe deciding how that would work, if it works, is the key to deciding where we want to end up and therefore what the mechanism to solving it is.
And I think that's probably also difficult even with the allocation of losses, because once you bring it into 28 to allocate losses against it and take it back to even because almost all the views apart from VC would have some interaction between 9 and 28, even exception with the exception of impairment. So I think that's there anyhow. that issue.
I agree. And then, so I think Andrew or Reinhardt said, if I'm allocating losses or I'm impairing under IAS 36, what am I doing with the finance income that goes on a different line in the income statement and so on and so on? I just think we need to pull it all together so we understand what the conceptual whole is. And then specifically, if that's what we're going to do, specifically exclude it from the scope.
Surely somebody encountered that, though, even before IFRS 9.
Oh, yeah. I think that the difference, which the staff paper points out, is if you're in an incurred loss model, then you'd be testing for impairment under IAS 28 to IAS 36 using the same indicators as you would under IAS 39. What's changed is moving to an expected loss model in IFRS 9.
No, I was talking about the recognition of finance income.
Oh, yeah, it's always going to be on a different line.
I'm going to take Martin first and then Sue.
Yeah, pretty much echoing. I believe there's something to fix. There is diversity, and I do not believe that with this non-agenda decision we do the right thing. So I would put it on the agenda. I believe we need to have an amendment.
Sue?
Given that we may, as a result of this, end up with long-term and potentially subordinated funding instruments having an incurred loss model applied to them rather than an expected loss model applied to them, if we go down the route that of putting all the impairment in 28, I think to reduce the amount of flip-flopping between the committee and the board, it might be good early on to flag to the board that that's a potential outcome and make sure there's sort of no screams of differences of opinion early on in the process, just to
and
understanding how it all sort of pulls together, I think, is key to that.
Okay. Well, I, when I started out on this, passionately believed in view A, which I didn't hear anybody pick as their first choice. So shows there may be value in me not having a vote. I heard a fair amount of support for the approach that the staff proposes, which is to put it under 28 for purposes of impairment. Recognition, measurement, other than impairment, classification, everything else stays in 9. Am I correct that that's the approach?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're saying yes. But that it has to be through the formative amendment, and I believe it's more than an annual improvement. We can't do that on the fly, so let's bring it back to the next meeting. Suggested wording of an amendment.
Okay, and I think it'll be important, Wayne, if I'm picking up, is how do the mechanics merge together?
Yeah.
Because that's also a key thing we need to analyze.
Well, we can do a lot of that stuff in an amendment that we can't in a
Chung Wu? In real world, the amount of this kind of long-term interests are also significant.
Are they?
I'm saying in the markets, this kind of situation is a widespread and very significant kind of phenomenon.
Yeah.
Maybe as Sue said, if that's so big, then might be we'd better think very carefully whether we should, not to apply IFRS 9 new models to this kind of thing. So before coming to us, maybe we need kind of severe, some kind of impact of the real world.
I think if you look at my impression is if you look at the restrictions in 28 that are imposed to get into this category in the first place, I guess anybody thinks possible, but it would be difficult for me to visualize somebody structuring a transaction and giving up all of the rights that you have to give up just to get into this category. So this may be one that's very important to somebody who has it, but in the grand scheme of things doesn't happen that frequently. John?
Just a couple of points. One, to confirm, it's very common that funding of the investment in associates is done through long-term interest other than ordinary shares.
Yeah.
It's very common. And I think the clarity and narrowness is not quite in practice what you would. There's actually a lot of debate about whether things are long-term interests or not, are in the nature of equity. So the only thing point I was going to make was in relation to the amendment. I mean, I think this is an area where an illustrative example with the amendment might be very useful about how the mechanics would work if you're going to go with view D, because I do think there's going to be some complexity to how that would actually play out if you have impairment losses.
Yeah. Okay, point taken. That's why you guys are in practice and we're not. Sue?
The other thing, obviously, and I'm looking at Michael as I say this, that I think the board might raise is the fact that we've put a number of other equity-related things on hold because of the review of what the heck the equity method's actually shooting for. So this might play into it a bit as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and we also take the point that the need to do informal consultations with board members, other than the four of you are already here, to make sure they're cognizant of the issue and what we plan to do with it. Okay? So stay tuned. We'll see you next meeting.
Yep.
Thank you.